Welcome to Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy, a careers consultant here in DCU Career Service. If you haven't already listened to part one of this two-part conversation with Dr. Martin McAleese, strongly recommend you take some time out and listen to part one first. But if you're ready for part two, we're going to pick up the conversation with Martin as he speaks about his own confidence, his own struggles with it, and why he thinks confidence and building confidence is so very important. Enjoy.
Confidence ebbs and flows as you go through life. Confidence is not a static thing. It's dynamic. And you never get to a stage where you can say, well, now, I have enough confidence to do me for the rest of my life. It doesn't work like that. In the same way as you can never say you're fully educated, nor can you say, well, now, I have enough mental health resilience to deal with anything that life throws at me. It doesn't work. None of those things work like that. So the question for me and for so many other people is, how do you deal with that lack of confidence? And I think the first step, probably the most important step, is to accept that it is normal, not abnormal. It's common, not uncommon. But you're not the only person in the world ever who's suffering from this degree of lack of confidence and struggling with confidence generally. And what you have to do, so that's the first step. And then leading on from that, I think you've got to put yourself in positions where you're actually stretching your confidence. And maybe to explain that better, I would do so in the context of a definition of confidence. I'm not sure where I got this from, but for confidence is defined as the ability to translate or to convert thought into action without over-engineering or overthinking the process. So what that means is that if the thought and the action are almost contemporaneous, confidence is good. The longer the time between the action of speaking up, if you like, and the thought, the longer that space, the less the confidence. And if you never speak up, if you never action, then confidence is pretty shattered. So that's what I've done over the years. I have put myself in a position where I have to really challenge myself to work at this issue around confidence. But you know, one of the greatest assets that you have if you have struggled with confidence is that I think you more easily intuit a lack of confidence in others, and in particularly in young people. And once you intuit that, you can go about the business of helping that young person to build their confidence. And I think in some ways that's the greatest gift that you can put at the service of anybody. So going forwards then to the loyalist engagement and holding back, yes, there would have been an element of dealing with confidence in that first step. So in other words, you've got to have the confidence and the courage to take the first step and to take a risk. But confidence will play a part in all of these things, because it's easier to stand back, not to take the risk, and not have to deal with an outcome that is possibly negative and damaging. So,
with the loyalists over a period of time, and obviously as you're getting, I suppose, more open with one another and more discursive and maybe having a chat, you know, around, you know, what their thoughts and feelings were during that reach out phase, did you kind of start to build, you know, a bit like what you were saying about the confidence? You know, most people have a level of confidence that definitely needs work on. You know, it could be a situational confidence, it could be a relationship confidence, confidence in work. I mean, there is probably 40 different shades of confidence out there.
Yeah.
But were you able to, I suppose, tap into maybe they weren't that confident either? Or did you feel you were kind of maybe caught up maybe in your own confidence issues at the time?
I think that they had great difficulties too, because don't forget, they could easily have been accused of fraternizing with the enemy. That's the way myself and Mary would have been regarded in their community. They would have could have been accused of betrayal by the rank and file. So it obviously took a huge confidence to respond so generously.
Yeah.
A huge courage to respond so generously, because let's not forget that those accusations, potential of betrayal and fraternizing with the enemy, could have very brutal consequences in a paramilitary environment. So I think that they too they too would have probably in their hearts and soul realized that this had to be done just as we did. Mm. But exactly trying to confront the same dilemmas of exposure and ridicule and maybe losing their status, being soft, being weak, being not as macho as perhaps the rank and file would have expected them to be. So it worked two ways, Siobhan, really. And as I say, when I talk about the generosity of their response, which was immediate, and as I said earlier, it left me thinking, why didn't we do this before? Mm. I think part of that response was one of relief, that it worked so well. And I think that comes into it in a way as well, the relief of knowing, my God, I did the right thing. It was the right thing to do. And there's a huge relief and release in that. And that in itself is very energizing and leads you on to steps 2, 3, 4, 5, which becomes easier, obviously.
Just bringing you back into the, you know, move to the moving down south and into Phoenix Park and things like that. I mean, obviously, you both yourself and Mary and your family were actually living up the north at the time, and your life and your everyday life and your friends and your family, you know, there was lots going on there that your lives were quite built around the current lives, and you were going to have to move to a different type of world, you know, a different type of location. So the career decision, you know, would have had a wider family impact. Can you talk about a bit about that transition? Because some of our listeners, you know, would be, say, could have to move on secondment abroad or move to a different part of Ireland for their roles, or you know, make different decisions that doesn't just affect them as an individual. It's a wider family decision.
Yeah, there's a couple of aspects to that, Siobhan. The first one, I think, I'll mention for me, it was the biggest challenge that faced us in 97 when we moved from the Strever, where we lived in a rural village in South County Down, to the Irish. The big issue, the big challenge was our children. The kids at that stage were with three kids. They were twins of 12 and a 14-year-old, and all three attended a convent co-ed school in Kilkeel. And let's think about it from their perspective. They were suddenly plucked from that school, from their friends, from the rural village that they lived in, from family, the wider family lived there, and suddenly deposited in Dublin with no say. And I remember I had the job of picking them up from their school on their last day and witnessing them saying goodbye to their friends and to their teachers and getting into the back of the car to drive the 2.5 hours, as it was then, to Dublin. And as soon as the doors closed, they began sobbing. And they sobbed the whole way to Dublin. And I was driving and saying to myself, what in the name of God have we done here? What impact will this have on these children going into their teenage years? And what can we do to fix that? And what we did, one of the things that we did was we had to decide on new schools. And the way we handled in Dublin, and the way we handled that was, we asked the vice principal of the school that they had attended in the north, would he come to Dublin and would he go around a number of schools, effectively interview the principal, talk to teachers, get an understanding of the school, of the ethos and that, and then could he compile a list of 3 schools which he reckoned any one of which would suit our children. And what we did was we then gave a list of those three schools to our children and said, look, you choose. Whichever one of those 3 schools you want to attend is okay by us. And that was an attempt to give them some ownership of the move, some say at least in part, in terms of that very traumatic move for them. And what they did then was they went to each of those 3 schools and they sat in on a few classes, say spent a morning in each of those schools, and eventually they decided on the schools. And that began, it moved towards a positive change in their outlook. But still, it took almost a year before they settled in. We used to go back to Strever every weekend. But, you know, they made new friends and they settled in. And the absolute confirmation of that was when they donned the blue jersey to go to Croke Park to support the Dogs. I found that very hard.
I was going to say, was that a kind of a moment?
That was a real problem. But the other thing that was important, really, and it could have been a huge challenge, Siobhan, but it didn't actually happen because we were very aware that they had to evolve to avoid buying into the celeb culture, if you like, because of where they lived and who their mommy was. And we were worried about that. And so, but we were very lucky because they themselves intuited this and they stayed in the background. So give you an example of how they handled that. And we had no say in this, but we're very proud of the fact that this is the way they reacted. They would not bring a newfound friend home until they were sure that that newfound friend was a friend of theirs because of who they were and not because of who their mother was or where they lived. And that was very reassuring. And the other example of that was that when they were out and about and they would meet people and maybe wider peer group in school, when asked where do you live, they would never say the Arras or the Phoenix Park. They'd always say, oh, should we live in Castlenock
or
Blanchardstown? And that was really, like, we were very lucky that they avoided a difficulty for us in terms of dealing with the celeb thing. And of course, we made life very, as normal as we could for them. We were taking them shopping, we were taking them to the cinema, we were taking them to McDonald's or wherever we were, so to make life as normal as possible. We were very lucky too that my father came to live with us. He stayed with us from that first day he moved down to Dunshock. And so he came and he was a steady influence in the background. In fact, to be quite honest with you, Siobhan, he was the third and the most important parent in their family. So no matter what we would say, they would always take it back to him, and he was the final arbiter of everything, and he was the one that finally decided. And we were quite happy to see that relationship between him and his grandchildren. So he was absolutely crucial in that settling in. But it just shows you that kids will settle in provided they're not of an age. And what I mean by that, you know, if they were, say, for example, those children were not two 12-year-olds and a 14-year-old, but say two 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds, they probably wouldn't have come to Dublin with us. They'd probably have stayed and finished their education in Ross Trevor. And that would have been a very difficult thing to handle for us, to be separated. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, you can't really tell a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old that, here, guys, we're picking up and we're taking away out of this environment and putting it in this strange place. They might have bought that and would have resented and would have resisted that. But 14 and the two 12-year-olds, it worked in our favour that we were able to bring them and settle them in Dublin. And things then progressed really well in terms of their own education from that point.
Yeah. No, but it's great. And there's great tips within that, because people do, like, throughout their careers, they do have to move the family home. They have to move abroad. There's so many reasons, you know, because we're very much a global workforce now, and careers don't always remain local to us at as much as we want them to be. So I'm just kind of thinking, where are you right now in your career? You know, what's next for you right now, or is there anything in particular in mind, or is that all to be unveiled yet?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I remember being at a dinner in London a number of years ago, and it was this roundtable discussion about where people would see themselves in 2, 3, 5, 10 years time. And of course, everybody made their contributions, and I was quite taken aback because everybody seemed to know exactly where they were going to be in 2 years, 3, 5 years. And I said, look, I really envy you people, because, and maybe I don't really envy you, because you all seem to have your lives planned, or do you know where you're going? I said, I have an emotion. I'm doing some things at the moment. They will finish. I'll be free again. And then I'll get involved in other things. I don't know what they're going to be. I don't know what area they're going to be in. The only thing I know is that they will be different to anything they've done before. And that is the case as it stands at the moment. I've been very privileged to have been involved in many things since we left the Arras, including being Chancellor of DCU and many other things. And they're all coming to an end now. My term in DCU ends this July, having spent the 10 years there. So I will, in a sense, come the autumn time of this year, be free of a lot of things that I have been doing over this last 20 years. Sure, I'm looking forward with an innocence.
Yeah.
Siobhan.
Yeah, and you're right to be that way. Yeah.
1922 will bring, and so be it, and I will react accordingly. But I will be involved in something. No idea yet what it is. And that's the beauty of it. The uncertainty of it, the unpredictability of it. They just don't know. That's brilliant.
So I'm just going to wrap up now. So, you know, you have given us so many, I suppose, a deeper understanding about you, your own career decisions, the impact of your family's career decisions on you and on yours on them, and how, you know, relationships are very important. You definitely touched in on that. You very much touched in just some of the things that I picked up, you know, by just tapping into that, you know, your own natural wisdom, the natural courage that you have, and courage always has to be worked on. And I thought your points around confidence, and you know that confidence is a work in progress at all times in our lives and in different contexts, and I suppose not to maybe lean into the fears around our confidence or lack of confidence, that, as you said, it does ebb and flow and it might be gone, but it will come back through working and taking those first steps. But if you were to, I suppose, think about, say, anyone moving from a career transition to another career transition, what would be kind of maybe your top pieces of wisdoms or top tips that you'd like to share?
In moving from one
career, career to another, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's always, I mean, from a personal point of view, you can always figure out the benefits, and there's an impulse to do that, to make the change. But I think unless you're single with no commitments, you really have to consider the impact on your partner, spouse, whatever. I think that you have to do that. And particularly if there are children involved, because a change in career may in some cases involve moving out of the country or moving down the country and spending a long time away from home and maybe home just on weekends. And obviously, in the case where there are a lot of where there are children involved, that will impose an extra burden on your partner or your spouse. And that's the context in which I've tried to give my answer to the question, Siobhan, because if there are difficulties in the relationship, and it's not going as smoothly, then that change can have fairly serious consequences. But if we assume that the relationship is strong and it's well-founded, it's based on respect and genuine love and affection, then I think the first thing that has to be done is that the two people sit down and have a very open and honest discussion. And as a result of that, you may very well find that the partner on whom the extra burden falls because of the change of direction or career direction of the other is quite happy to accept that additional burden and is encouraging and supporting, as was the case in terms of what Mary did for me way back when I decided to study dentistry. And there are no issues there. In other words, the relationship is so strong it can sustain that kind of change, if you like. But, you know, if after that discussion you find yourself in a situation or the relationship finds that there is tension and there is a potential for hurt and disagreement and maybe resentment and bitterness and those things, then I think the person whose career is to benefit because of change really has to decide, you know, is this change really worth it? Is this change in terms of my own personal development, does that trump the long-term health of my relationship, both with my partner, spouse, and with my children? And that's a call that you have to make, that person has to make. And it's very difficult to go beyond more than that general comment, because you really then need to be more tuned into the individual circumstances, which can range on a very broad spectrum. But I think as a principle, sometimes you have to figure out what is in the best interest of the relationship and the health of the relationship, as opposed to what is best for me individually. That's the question, and that can be a difficult one to answer. But I think I've seen it work in both ways. I mean, in a really good relationship, there's never any issues around these types of things. But if there's any kind of, you know, shakiness in a relationship, it can just explode and into all kinds of debris. that someone has to pick up. And unfortunately, you find a lot of these cases that children are the first ones to suffer, and to suffer most negatively.
That's brilliant. Thanks a million, Martin. Just one passing comment, I suppose, or a small discussion before we finish up. I was very taken about what you said about your own father and how, as a grandfather, he brought a huge dimension to both your own life and maybe, you know, a different relationship between you and your father, because he became very much, you know, part of your story of homemaking and family life. And we very much know, as we in the career service and wider college colleagues in the university, we're hugely aware of the role of parents in our students' lives and the role of grandparents in our students' lives, because many of our parents are both working. And we do hear an awful lot about how positively influential grandparents are in their lives, and how much they love them and admire them, and how they're a huge positive source of influence to them. And it just goes to show you, we may be moving towards very highly individualized societies, you know, but family and that wider village, I think, is hugely, hugely important. And that brings me, how are you as a grandparent now? Is that influencing you as a grandparent?
I'm suffering because we haven't seen the two little fellas since Christmas. Mm. And we're looking forward now, hopefully having the second jab, as they say.
Yeah, the freedom jab, soon. Some people are calling it.
Yeah, we'll be able to go and see them. But it's funny, you know, like, you FaceTime them, and it's very hard, really, to engage with a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old on FaceTime.
Did they bring you for a walk around the house and it's like a washing machine trying to watch it? Yeah.
They just wanted to get back to the game, to playing on their devices. And I remember, it's a kind of a phony relationship because you just can't engage, because their world is the here and now, and it's on what they're doing on their, whether it's a game they're playing or they're talking to their friends or whatever. But it's interesting. I remember Emma, our daughter, is the mother of the two little fellas, and we were FaceTiming her one day a number of months ago, and the youngest fella was on her knee, the 4-year-old as he was then, and Mary was talking to the two of them, and at one point the little fella turned to his mother and said, "Turn her off." So it just shows you, like, they don't, they react, they really react face to face. And that's where the joy is.
Yeah.
Sitting on your knee and having a chat. But you cannot, I am convinced, do that. It's a kind of phony thing through FaceTime.
It's better than nothing, but yeah.
But it can be frustrating. But
yeah.
You know, you would like to engage more, but they're in a different world. You know, we're adults and they're children, and they just different way of doing things to us. Plus the fact that, the other interesting thing that I find amazed, I'm being disconnected in some ways from them. They were here for a few days when the restrictions were lifted last summer, and up in Roscommon where we live. And I remember saying to the young one, the 4-year-old, "Tell me what you like most about this house." And the answer threw me. The answer was, "There is Wi-Fi in every room." Think about a 4-year-old saying that. That just shows you how literate they are, digitally or whatever. I mean, I'm still struggling. I often admit, how do you do that to Charlie Dell? How do you get those things up on the screen? And how do you get rid of them? And how do you do what you're doing there? How do you overlay one thing and another? All these kind of effects that they can, throw these things at us if it's totally second nature, where we're thinking and deliberating and worried.
Think we're going to break it, you know, because we remember computers coming out and getting lectures from it that if you touch the button, the thing would blow up and
They have no fear about the technology.
They'll have their own fears in their own life. There'll be something to challenge them as well, you know, and that's for sure, you know.
And then the other final thing I'll share with you, I remember FaceTiming one of them And obviously, he didn't really want to speak too long. He was doing something else.
Yes.
And he came straight back to her. But I have only 4%. And she said, what? Yeah, the battery was showing only 4% charge, so he didn't really want to waste the 4% on this granny. I thought that was very funny.
Oh, yeah, they get cruel on you. Listen, thank you so much for your time. Okay. I really, really appreciate it, and thanks for sharing, because one of the things that is we learn through the careers of others, and we learn through the doings of others, and we can tap into your experiences and relate them to our own and say, right, okay, maybe I will be able to do it. I've heard somebody else doing it. It was tough. These were the obstacles. Inch by inch, we moved it along, and we moved our lives along. So listen, thank you so much for that. We really appreciate it.
Siobhan, my pleasure.